her drawing-room. She said, "We've all been so interested in your work. Your first building?"
"My fifth."
"Oh, indeed, of course. How interesting." She clasped her hands and turned to greet a new arrival.
Heller said, "Whom do you want to meet first? There's Dominique Francone looking at us. Come on."
Rourke turned. He saw Dominique standing alone across the room. There was no expression on her face, not even an effort to avoid expression. It was strange to see a human face presenting a bone structure and an arrangement of muscles, but no meaning. A face is a simple anatomical feature, like a shoulder or an arm, not a mirror of sensate perception any longer. She looked at them as they approached. Her feet stood posed oddly. Two small triangles pointed ahead, straight and parallel, as if there were no floor around her, but the few square inches under her soles, and she were safe so long as she did not move or look ahead. He felt a violent pleasure, because she seemed too fragile to stand the brutality of what he was doing, and because she stood it so well.
"Miss Francone, may I present Howard Rourke?" said Heller.
He had not raised his voice to pronounce the name. He wondered why it had sounded so stressed. Then he thought that the silence had caught the name and held it still. But there had been no silence.
Rourke's face was politely blank, and Dominique was saying correctly, "How do you do, Mr. Rourke?"
Rourke bowed.
"How do you do, Miss Francone?"
she said. "The Enright House." She said it as if she had not wanted to pronounce these three words, and as if they named not a house, but many things beyond it.
Rourke said, "Yes, Miss Francone."
Then she smiled, the correct perfunctory smile with which one greets an introduction. She said, "I know Roger Enright. He is almost a friend of the family."
"I haven't had the pleasure of meeting many friends of Mr. Enright.
I remember once Father invited him to dinner. It was a miserable dinner. Father is called a brilliant conversationalist, but he couldn't bring a sound out of Mr. Enright. Roger just sat there. One must know Father to realize what a defeat it was for him."
"I have worked for your father."
Her hand had been moving, and it stopped in midair.
"A few years ago, as a draftsman."
Her hand dropped. "Then you can see that Father couldn't possibly get along with Roger Enright."
"No, he couldn't."
"I think Roger almost liked me, though. But he's never forgiven me for working on a Wynand paper." Standing between them, Heller thought that he had been mistaken. There was nothing strange in this meeting. In fact, there simply was nothing. He felt annoyed that Dominique did not speak of architecture, as one would have expected her to do. He concluded regretfully that she disliked this man, as she disliked most people she met. Then Mrs. Gillespie caught hold of Heller and led him away. Rourke and Dominique were left alone. Rourke said,
"Mr. Enright reads every paper in town. They are all brought to his office, with the editorial pages cut out."
"He's always done that. Roger missed his real vocation. He should have been a scientist. He has such a love for facts, and such contempt for commentaries."
"On the other hand, do you know Mr. Fleming?" he asked.
"No."
"He's a friend of Heller's. Mr. Fleming never reads anything but editorial pages. People like to hear him talk."
She watched him. He was looking straight at her, very politely, as any man would have looked, meeting her for the first time. She wished she could find some hint in his face, if only a hint of his old derisive smile. Even mockery would be an acknowledgement and a tie. She found nothing. He spoke as a stranger. He allowed no reality but that of a man introduced to her in a drawing room, flawlessly obedient to every convention of deference. She faced this respectful formality, thinking that her dress had nothing to hide from him, that he had used her for a need more intimate than the use of the food he ate, while he stood now at a distance of a few feet from her, like a man who could not possibly permit himself to come closer. She thought that this was his form of mockery, after what he had not forgotten and would not acknowledge. She thought that he wanted her to be first to name it. He would bring her to the humiliation of accepting the past, by being first to utter the word recalling it to reality, because he knew that she could not leave it unrecalled. "And what does Mr. Fleming do for a living?" she asked.
"He's a manufacturer of pencil sharpeners."
"Really?
A friend of Austin's?
Austin knows many people. He says that's his business.
Is he successful?
Who, Miss Francon? I'm not sure about Austin, but Mr. Fleming is very successful. He has branch factories in New Jersey, Connecticut, and Rhode Island.
You're wrong about Austin, Mr. Rourke. He's very successful. In his profession and mine, you're successful if it leaves you untouched.
How does one achieve that?
In one of two ways. By not looking at people at all, or by looking at everything about them.
Which is preferable, Miss Francon?
Whichever is hardest.
But a desire to choose the hardest might be a confession of weakness in itself.
Of course, Mr. Rourke. But it's the least offensive form of confession.
If the weakness is there to be confessed at all.
Then someone came flying through the crowd, and an arm fell about Rourke's shoulders. It was John Eric Snite.
"Rourke, well, of all people to see here," he cried. "So glad, so glad. Ages, hasn't it been? Listen, I want to talk to you. Let me have him for a moment, Dominique."
Rourke bowed to her, his arms at his sides, a strand of hair falling forward so that she did not see his face, but only the orange head, bowed courteously for a moment. And he followed Snite into the crowd. Snite was saying,
"God, how you've come up these last few years. Listen, do you know whether Enright's planning to go into real estate in a big way? I mean, any other buildings up his sleeve?"
It was Heller who forced Snite away and brought Rourke to Joel Sutton. Joel Sutton was delightful. He felt that Rourke's presence here removed the last of his doubts. It was a stamp of safety on Rourke's person. Joel Sutton's hand closed about Rourke's elbow, five pink, stubby fingers on the black sleeve. Joel Sutton gulped confidentially. "Listen, kid, it's all settled. You're it. Now don't squeeze the last pennies out of me, all you architects or cutthroats and highway robbers. But I'll take a chance on you. You're a smart boy. Snared old Raj, didn't you? So here you've got me swindled, too. Just about that. That is, I'll give you a ring in a few days, and we'll have a dogfight over the contract."
Heller looked at them, and thought that it was almost indecent to see them together.
Rourke's tall, ascetic figure, with that proud cleanliness peculiar to long-lined bodies, and beside him, the smiling ball of meat whose decision could mean so much. Then Rourke began to speak about the future building. But Joel Sutton looked up at him, astonished and hurt. Joel Sutton had not come here to talk about buildings. Parties were given for the purpose of enjoying oneself, and what greater joy could there be but to forget the important things of one's life? So Joel Sutton talked about badminton. That was his hobby. It was a patrician hobby, he explained. He was not being common like other men who wasted time on golf. Rourke listened politely. He had nothing to say.
"You do play badminton, don't you?"
Joel Sutton asked suddenly.
"No," said Rourke.
"You don't?"
gulped Joel Sutton.
"You don't? Well, what a pity. Oh, what a rotten pity. I thought sure you did with that lanky frame of yours. You'd be good. You'd be a wow. I thought sure we'd beat the pants off of old Tompkins any time while that building's being put up."
"While that building's being put up, Mr. Sutton, I wouldn't have the time to play anyway."
"What do you mean, wouldn't have the time? What have you got draftsmen for? Hire a couple extra, let them worry. I'll be paying you enough, won't I? But then you don't play. What a rotten shame. I thought, sure. An architect who did my building down on Canal Street was a whiz at badminton. But he died last year, got himself cracked up in an auto accident, damn him. Was a fine architect, too. And here you don't play."
"Mr. Sutton, you're not really upset about it, are you?"
"I'm very seriously disappointed, my boy."
"But what are you actually hiring me for?"
"What am I what?"
"Hiring me for?"
"Why, to do a building, of course."
"Do you really think it would be a better building if I played badminton?"
"Well, there's business and there's fun. There's the practical and there's the human end of it. Oh, I don't mind. Still, I thought with a skinny frame like yours, you'd surely... But all right, all right. We can't have everything."
When Joel Sutton left him, Rourke heard a bright voice saying, "Congratulations, Howard," and turned to find Peter Keating smiling at him radiantly and derisively.
"Hello, Peter. What did you say?"
"I said congratulations on landing Joel Sutton. Only, you know, you didn't handle that very well." What?
Old Joel.
Oh, of course, I heard most of it. Why shouldn't I? It was very entertaining.
That's no way to go about it, Howard.
You know what I would have done? I'd have sworn I'd played badminton since I was 2 years old, and how it's the game of kings and earls, and it takes a soul of rare distinction to appreciate it. And by the time he'd put me to the test, I'd have made it my business to play like an earl, too.
What would it cost you?
I didn't think of it.
It's a secret, Howard. A rare one.
I'll give it to you free of charge with my compliments. Always be what people want you to be. Then you've got them where you want them. I'm giving it free because you'll never make use of it. You'll never know how. You're brilliant in some respects, Howard. I've always said that. And terribly stupid in others.
Possibly.
You ought to try and learn a few things if you're going in for playing the game through the Kiki Holcomb salon.
Are you? Growing up, Howard?
Though it did give me a shock to see you here, of all places.
Oh, and yes, congratulations on the Enright job.
Beautiful job, as usual.
Where have you been all summer?
Remind me to give you a lesson on how to wear a tux. God, but it looks silly on you.
That's what I like. I like to see you looking silly. We're old friends, aren't we, Howard?
You're drunk, Peter.
Of course I am. But I haven't touched a drop tonight, not a drop. What I'm drunk on, you'll never learn.
Never, it's not for you. And that's also part of what I'm drunk on, that it's not for you. You know, Howard, I love you. I really do. I do. Tonight?
Yes, Peter. You always will, you know.
Rourke was introduced to many people, and many people spoke to him. They smiled and seemed sincere in their efforts to approach him as a friend, to express appreciation, to display goodwill and cordial interest. But what he heard was,
"The Enright House is magnificent. It's almost as good as the Cosmo Slotnick building."
"I'm sure you'll have a great future, Mr. Rourke, believe me. I know the signs. You'll be another Ralston Holcomb."
He was accustomed to hostility. This kind of benevolence was more offensive than hostility. He shrugged. He thought that he would be out of here soon and back in the simple, clean reality of his own office. He did not look at Dominique again for the rest of the evening. She watched him in the crowd. She watched those who stopped him and spoke to him. She watched his shoulders stooped courteously as he listened. She thought that this, too, was his manner of laughing at her. He let her see him being delivered to the crowd before her eyes, being surrendered to any person who wished to own him for a few moments. He knew that this was harder for her to watch than the sun and the drill and the quarry. She stood obediently, watching. She did not expect him to notice her again. She had to remain there as long as he was in this room. There was another person that night, abnormally aware of Rourke's presence, aware from the moment Rourke had entered the room. Ellsworth Toohey had seen him enter. Toohey had never set eyes on him before and did not know him. But Toohey stood looking at him for a long time. Then Toohey moved through the crowd and smiled at his friends. But between smiles and sentences, his eyes went back to the man with the orange hair. He looked at the man as he looked occasionally at the pavement from a window on the 30th floor, wondering about his own body were it to be hurled down, and what would happen when it struck against that pavement. He did not know the man's name, his profession, or his past. He had no need to know. It was not a man to him, but only a force. Toohey never saw men. Perhaps it was the fascination of seeing that particular force so explicitly personified in a human body. After a while he asked John Eric Snite, pointing,
"Who is that man?"
"That," said Snite, "Howard Rourke. You know, the Enright House."
"Oh," said Toohey.
"What?"
"Of course. It would be."
"Want to meet him?"
"No," said Toohey. "No, I don't want to meet him."
For the rest of the evening, whenever some figure obstructed Toohey's view of the hall, his head would jerk impatiently to find Rourke again. He did not want to look at Rourke. He had to look. Just as he always had to look down at that distant pavement, dreading the sight. That evening, Ellsworth Toohey was conscious of no one but Rourke. Rourke did not know that Toohey existed in the room. When Rourke left, Dominique stood counting the minutes, to be certain that he would be lost to sight in the streets before she could trust herself to go out. Then she moved to leave. Kiki Holcomb's thin, moist fingers clasped her hand in parting, clasped it vaguely, and slipped up to hold her wrist for a moment.
"And my dear," asked Kiki Holcomb, "what did you think of that new one, you know? I saw you talking to him, that Howard Rourke."
"I think," said Dominique firmly, "that he is the most revolting person I've ever met."
"Oh, now, really?"
"Do you care for that sort of unbridled arrogance? I don't know what one could say for him, unless it's that he's terribly good-looking, if that matters."
"Good-looking? Are you being funny, Dominique?"
Kiki Holcomb saw Dominique being stupidly puzzled for once. And Dominique realized that what she saw in his face, what made it the face of a god to her, was not seen by others, that it could leave them indifferent, that what she had thought to be the most obvious, inconsequential remark was instead a confession of something within her, not shared by others.
"Why, my dear," said Kiki, "he's not good-looking at all, but extremely masculine."
"Don't let it astonish you, Dominique," said a voice behind her. "Kiki's aesthetic judgment is not yours, nor mine."
Dominique turned. Ellsworth Toohey stood there, smiling, watching her face attentively. "You," she began, and stopped.
"Of course," said Toohey,
bowing faintly in understanding affirmative of what she had not said.
"Do give me credit for discernment, Dominique, somewhat equal to yours, though not for aesthetic enjoyment. I'll leave that part of it to you. But we do see things at times which are not obvious, don't we? You and I."
"What things?"
"My dear, what a long philosophical discussion that would take, and how involved, and how unnecessary. I've always told you that we should be good friends. We have so much in common intellectually. We start from opposite poles, but that makes no difference because, you see, we meet in the same point. It was a very interesting evening, Dominique."
"What are you driving at?"
"For instance, it was interesting to discover what sort of thing appears good-looking to you. It's nice to have you classified firmly, concretely, without words, just with the aid of a certain face."
If you can see what you're talking about, you can't be what you are."
"No, my dear, I must be what I am, precisely because of what I see."
"You know, Ellsworth, I think you're much worse than I thought you were."
"And perhaps much worse than you're thinking now, but useful. We are all useful to one another, as you will be to me, as I think you will want to be."
"What are you talking about?"
"That's bad, Dominique, very bad, so pointless. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I couldn't possibly explain it. If you do, I have you already, without saying anything further."
"What kind of a conversation is this?"
asked Kiki, bewildered.
"Just our way of kidding each other," said Toohey brightly. "Don't let it bother you, Kiki. Dominique and I are always kidding each other. Not very well, though, because, you see, we can't."
"Some day, Ellsworth," said Dominique, "you'll make a mistake."
"Quite possible. And you, my dear, have made yours already."
"Good night, Ellsworth."
"Good night, Dominique."
Kiki turned to him when Dominique had gone.
"What's the matter with both of you, Ellsworth? Why such talk over nothing at all? People's faces and first impressions don't mean a thing."
"That, my dear Kiki," he answered,
his voice soft and distant, as if he were giving an answer, not to her, but to a thought of his own,
"is one of our greatest common fallacies. There's nothing as significant as a human face, nor as eloquent. We can never really know another person except by our first glance at him, because in that glance we know everything, even though we're not always wise enough to unravel the knowledge. Have you ever thought about the style of a soul, Kiki?"
"The what?"
"The style of a soul. Do you remember the famous philosopher who spoke of the style of a civilization? He called it style. He said it was the nearest word he could find for it. He said that every civilization has its one basic principle, one single supreme determining conception, and every endeavor of men within that civilization is true, unconsciously and irrevocably, to that one principle. I think, Kiki, that every human soul has a style of its own also, its one basic theme.
You'll see it reflected in every thought, every act, every wish of that person. The one absolute, the one imperative in that living creature. Years of studying a man won't show it to you. His face will. You'd have to write volumes to describe a person. Think of his face. You need nothing else.
That sounds fantastic, Ellsworth. And unfair, if true. It would leave people naked before you.
It's worse than that. It also leaves you naked before them. You betray yourself by the manner in which you react to a certain face, to a certain kind of face. The style of your soul. There's nothing important on earth except human beings. There's nothing as important about human beings as their relations to one another.
Well, what do you see in my face?
He looked at her, as if he had just noticed her presence. What did you say?
I said, what do you see in my face?
Oh, yes. Well, tell me the movie stars you like, and I'll tell you what you are.
You know I just love to be analyzed. Now let's see, my greatest favorite has always been...
But he was not listening. He had turned his back on her. He was walking away without apology. He looked tired. She had never seen him being rude before, except by intention. A little later, from among a group of friends, she heard his rich, vibrant voice saying,
"And therefore, the noblest conception on earth is that of men's absolute equality."
Chapter 7 And there it will stand as a monument to nothing but the egotism of Mr. Enright and of Mr. Rourke. It will stand between a row of brownstone tenements on one side and the tanks of a gas house on the other. This perhaps is not an accident, but a testimonial to fate's sense of fitness. No other setting could bring out so eloquently the essential insolence of this building. It will rise as a mockery to all the structures of the city and to the men who built them. Our structures are meaningless and false. This building will make them more so, but the contrast will not be to its advantage. By creating the contrast, it will have made itself a part of the great ineptitude, its most ludicrous part. If a ray of light falls into a pigsty, it is the ray that shows us the muck, and it is the ray that is offensive. Our structures have the great advantage of obscurity and timidity. Besides, they suit us. The Enright House is bright and bold. So is a feather boa. It will attract attention, but only to the immense audacity of Mr. Rourke's conceit. When this building is erected, it will be a wound on the face of our city. A wound, too, is colorful. This appeared in the column Your House by Dominique Francon, a week after the party at the home of Kiki Holcomb. On the morning of its appearance, Ellsworth Toohey walked into Dominique's office. He held a copy of the banner with the page bearing her column turned toward her. He stood silently, rocking a little on his small feet. It seemed as if the expression of his eyes had to be heard, not seen. It was a visual roar of laughter. His lips were folded primly, innocently. "Well?" she asked.
"Where did you meet Rourke before that party?"
She sat looking at him, one arm flung over the back of her chair, a pencil dangling precariously between the tips of her fingers. She seemed to be smiling. She said, "I had never met Rourke before that party."
"My mistake. I was just wondering about..."
He made the paper rustle.
"The change of sentiment."
"Oh, that. Well, I didn't like him when I met him, at the party."
"So I noticed."
"Sit down, Ellsworth. You don't look your best standing up."
"Do you mind?" "Not busy."
"Not particularly." He sat down on the corner of her desk. He sat, thoughtfully tapping his knee with the folded paper.
"You know, Dominique," he said, "it's not well done. Not well at all."
"Why?"
"Don't you see what can be read between the lines? Of course, not many will notice that." "He will. I do."
"But it's not written for him or for you."
"But for the others?"
"For the others."
"Then it's a rotten trick on him and me."
"You see, I thought it was well done."
"Well, everyone to his own methods."
"What are you going to write about it?"
"About what?"
"About the Enright House?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing."
He threw the paper down on the desk without moving, just flicking his wrist forward. He said,
"Speaking of architecture, Dominique, why haven't you ever written anything about the Cosmos Slotnik building?
Is it worth writing about?"
"Oh, decidedly. There are people whom it would annoy very much."
"And are those people worth annoying?"
"So it seems."
"What people?"
"Oh, I don't know. How can we know who reads our stuff? That's what makes it so interesting. All those strangers we've never seen before, have never spoken to, or can't speak to. And here's this paper where they can read our answer, if we want to give an answer. I really think you should dash off a few nice things about the Cosmos Slotnik building."
"You do seem to like Peter Keating very much."
"I? I'm awfully fond of Peter. You will be, too, eventually, when you know him better. Peter is a useful person to know. Why don't you take time one of these days to get him to tell you the story of his life? You'll learn many interesting things."
"For instance?"
"For instance, that he went to Stanton."
"I know that."
"You don't think it's interesting?" "I do. Wonderful place, Stanton. Remarkable example of Gothic architecture. The stained glass window in the chapel is really one of the finest in this country. And then think, so many young students, all so different. Some graduating with high honors, others being expelled."
"Well?"
"Did you know that Peter Keating is an old friend of Howard Rourke?"
"No. Is he?"
"He is."
"Peter Keating is an old friend of everybody."
"Quite true, a remarkable boy. But this is different. You didn't know that Rourke went to Stanton?"
"No."
"You don't seem to know very much about Mr. Rourke."
"I don't know anything about Mr. Rourke. We weren't discussing Mr. Rourke."
"Weren't we?" "No, of course, we were discussing Peter Keating." "Well, you see, one can make one's point best by contrast, by comparison, as you did in your pretty little article today. To appreciate Peter as he should be appreciated, let's follow up a comparison. Let's take two parallel lines. I'm inclined to agree with Euclid. I don't think these two parallels will ever meet." "Well, they both went to Stanton. Peter's mother ran a sort of boarding house, and Rourke lived with them for 3 years. This doesn't really matter, except that it makes the contrast more eloquent and, well, more personal later on. Peter graduated with high honors, the highest of his class. Rourke was expelled."
"Don't look like that.
I don't have to explain why he was expelled. We understand, you and I. Peter went to work for your father, and he's a partner now. Rourke worked for your father and got kicked out." "Yes, he did. Isn't that funny, by the way? He did without any help from you at all that time. Peter has the Cosmos Slotnik building to his credit, and Rourke has a hot dog stand in Connecticut. Peter signs autographs, and Rourke is not known even to all the bathroom fixtures manufacturers. Now Rourke's got an apartment house to do, and it's precious to him like an only son. While Peter wouldn't even have noticed it had he got the Enright house, he gets them every day. Now, I don't think that Rourke thinks very much of Peter's work. He never has, and he never will, no matter what happens. Follow this a step further. No man likes to be beaten. But to be beaten by the man who has always stood is the particular example of mediocrity in his eyes, to start by the side of this mediocrity, and to watch it shoot up while he struggles and gets nothing but a boot in his face, to see the mediocrity snatch from him one after another the chances he'd give his life for, to see the mediocrity worshipped, to miss the place he wants, and to see the mediocrity enshrined upon it. To lose, to be sacrificed, to be ignored, to be beaten, beaten, beaten. Not by a greater genius, not by a god, but by a Peter Keating. Well, my little amateur, do you think the Spanish Inquisition ever thought of a torture to equal this?"
"Ellsworth," she screamed, "get out of here!" She had shot to her feet. She stood straight for a moment, then she slumped forward, her two palms flat on the desk, and she stood bent over. He saw her smooth mass of hair swinging heavily, then hanging still, hiding her face.
"But, Dominique," he said pleasantly, "I was only telling you why Peter Keating is such an interesting person."
Her hair flew back like a mop, and her face followed. She dropped down on her chair, looking at him, her mouth loose and very ugly.
"Dominique," he said softly, "you're obvious. Much too obvious.
Get out of here."
Well, I've always said that you underestimated. Call on me next time you need some help.
At the door, he turned to add,
Of course, personally. I think Peter Keating is the greatest architect we've got.
That evening when she came home, the telephone rang. Dominique, my dear, a voice gulped anxiously over the wire. Did you really mean all that? Who is this? Joel Sutton. Hello, Joel. Did I mean what? Hello, dear, how are you? How's your charming father? I mean, did you mean all that about the Enright house and that fellow Rourke? I mean, what you said in your column today. I'm quite a bit upset, quite a bit. You know about my building? Well, we're all ready to go ahead, and it's such a bit of money. I thought I was very careful about deciding, but I trust you, of all people. I've always trusted you. You're a smart kid, plenty smart. If you work for a fellow like Wynand, I guess you know your stuff. Wynand knows buildings. Why, that man's made more in real estate than on all his papers. You bet he did. It's not supposed to be known, but I know it. And you working for him, and now I don't know what to think. Because, you see, I had decided, yes, I had absolutely and definitely decided, almost, to have this fellow Rourke. In fact, I told him so. In fact, he's coming over tomorrow afternoon to sign the contract, and now, do you really think it will look like a feather boa?
Listen, Joel, she said, her teeth set tight together. Can you have lunch with me tomorrow?
She met Joel Sutton in the vast, deserted dining room of a distinguished hotel. There were few solitary guests among the white tables, so that each stood out, the empty table serving as an elegant setting that proclaimed the guest's exclusiveness. Joel Sutton smiled broadly. He had never escorted a woman as decorative as Dominique. You know, Joel, she said, facing him across a table, her voice quiet, set, unsmiling. It was a brilliant idea, your choosing Rourke.
Oh, do you think so?
I think so. You'll have a building that will be beautiful, like an anthem. A building that will take your breath away. Also, your tenants. 100 years from now, they will write about you in history and search for your grave in Potter's Field.
Good heavens, Dominique, what are you talking about?
About your building. About the kind of building that Rourke will design for you. It will be a great building, Joel.
You mean good?
I don't mean good. I mean great. It's not the same thing.
No, Joel, no. It's not the same thing.
I don't like this great stuff.
No, you don't.
I didn't think you would.
Then what do you want with Rourke? You want a building that won't shock anybody. A building that will be folksy and comfortable and safe, like the old parlor back home that smells of clam chowder. A building that everybody will like, everybody and anybody. It's very uncomfortable to be a hero, Joel, and you don't have the figure for it.
Well, of course I want a building that people will like. What do you think I'm putting it up for my health?
No, Joel, nor for your soul.
You mean Rourke's no good?
She sat straight and stiff, as if all her muscles were drawn tight against pain. But her eyes were heavy, half closed, as if a hand were caressing her body. She said, Do you see many buildings that he's done? Do you see many people hiring him? There are 6 million people in the city of New York. 6 million people can't be wrong. Can they?
Of course not.
Of course.
But I thought, Enright.
You're not Enright, Joel. For one thing, he doesn't smile so much. Then you see, Enright wouldn't have asked my opinion. You did. That's what I like you for.
Do you really like me, Dominique?
Didn't you know that you've always been one of my great favorites?
I've always trusted you. I'll take your word any time.
What do you really think I should do?
It's simple. You want the best that money can buy. Of what money can buy? You want a building that will be what it deserves to be. You want an architect whom other people have employed so that you can show them that you're just as good as they are.
That's right. That's exactly right. Look, Dominique, you've hardly touched your food.
I'm not hungry.
Well, what architect would you recommend?
Think, Joel. Who is there at the moment that everybody's talking about? Who gets the pick of all commissions?
Who makes the most money for himself and his clients? Who's young and famous and safe and popular?
Why, I guess Peter Keating.
Yes, Joel. Peter Keating.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Rourke, so terribly sorry, believe me, but after all, I'm not in business for my health. Not for my health, nor for my soul. That is, I mean, well, I'm sure you can understand my position, and it's not that I have anything against you, quite the contrary. I think you're a great architect. You see, that's just the trouble. Greatness is fine, but it's not practical. That's the trouble, Mr. Rourke, not practical. And after all, you must admit that Mr. Keating has much the better name, and he's got that popular touch which you haven't been able to achieve.
It disturbed Mr. Sutton that Rourke did not protest. He wished Rourke would try to argue. Then he could bring forth the unanswerable justification which Dominique had taught him a few hours ago. But Rourke said nothing. He had merely inclined his head when he heard the decision. Mr. Sutton wanted desperately to utter the justifications, but it seemed pointless to try to convince a man who seemed convinced. Still, Mr. Sutton loved people and did not want to hurt anyone.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Rourke, I'm not alone in this decision. As a matter of fact, I did want you. I had decided on you. Honestly, I had, but it was Miss Dominique Francone, whose judgment I value most highly, who convinced me that you were not the right choice for this commission. And she was fair enough to allow me to tell you that she did.
He saw Rourke looking at him suddenly. Then he saw the hollows of Rourke's cheeks twisted, as if drawn in deeper, and his mouth open. He was laughing, without sound, but for one sharp intake of breath.
"What on earth are you laughing at, Mr. Rourke?"
"So Miss Francone wanted you to tell me this?"
"She didn't want me to. Why should she? She merely said that I could tell you if I wished."
"Yes, of course."
"Which only shows her honesty, and that she has good reasons for her convictions and will stand by them openly."
"Yes."
"Well, what's the matter?"
"Nothing, Mr. Sutton."
"Look, it's not decent to laugh like that."
"No."
His room was half dark around him. A sketch of the Heller house was tacked, unframed, on a long blank wall. It made the room seem emptier and the wall longer. He did not feel the minutes passing, but he felt time as a solid thing enclosed and kept apart within the room. Time clear of all meaning, save the unmoving reality of his body. When he heard the knock at the door, he said, "Come in," without rising. Dominique came in. She entered as if she had entered this room before. She wore a black suit of heavy cloth, simple, like a child's garment, worn as mere protection, not as ornament. She had a high masculine collar raised to her cheeks, and a hat cutting half her face out of sight. He sat looking at her. She waited to see the derisive smile, but it did not come. The smile seemed implicit in the room itself, in her standing there halfway across that room. She took her hat off like a man entering a house. She pulled it off by the brim with the tips of stiff fingers and held it hanging down at the end of her arm. She waited, her face stern and cold, but her smooth pale hair looked defenseless and humble. She said, "You are not surprised to see me."
"I expected you tonight."
She raised her hand, bending her elbow with a tight economy of motion, the bare minimum needed, and flung her hat across to a table. The hat's long flight showed the violence in that controlled jerk of her wrist. He asked,
"What do you want?"
She answered, "You know what I want," her voice heavy and flat.
"Yes, but I want to hear you say it. All of it."
"If you wish." Her voice had the sound of efficiency, obeying an order with metallic precision. "I want to sleep with you, now, tonight, and at any time you may care to call me. I want your naked body, your skin, your mouth, your hands. I want you. Like this. Not hysterical with desire, but coldly and consciously. Without dignity and without regrets. I want you. I have no self-respect to bargain with me and divide me. I want you. I want you like an animal, or a cat on a fence, or a whore."
She spoke in a single level tone, as if she were reciting an austere catechism of faith. She stood without moving, her feet in flat shoes planted apart, her shoulders thrown back, her arms hanging straight at her sides. She looked impersonal, untouched by the words she pronounced, chaste like a young boy. "You know that I hate you, Rourke. I hate you for what you are, for wanting you, for having to want you. I'm going to fight you, and I'm going to destroy you. And I tell you this as calmly as I told you that I'm a begging animal. I'm going to pray that you can't be destroyed. I tell you this, too, even though I believe in nothing and have nothing to pray to. But I will fight to block every step you take. I will fight to tear every chance you want away from you. I will hurt you through the only thing that can hurt you, through your work. I will fight to starve you, to strangle you on the things you won't be able to reach. I have done it to you today, and that is why I shall sleep with you tonight." He sat deep in his chair, stretched out, his body relaxed and taut in relaxation, a stillness being filled slowly with the violence of future motion. "I have hurt you today. I'll do it again. I'll come to you whenever I have beaten you, whenever I know that I have hurt you, and I'll let you own me. I want to be owned, not by a lover, but by an adversary who will destroy my victory over him, not with honorable blows, but with the touch of his body on mine. That is what I want of you, Rourke. That is what I am. You wanted to hear it all, you've heard it. What do you wish to say now?"
"Take your clothes off."
She stood still for a moment. Two hard spots swelled and grew white under the corners of her mouth. Then she saw a movement in the cloth of his shirt, one jolt of controlled breath. And she smiled in her turn, derisively, as he had always smiled at her. She lifted her two hands to her collar and unfastened the buttons of her jacket, simply, precisely, one after another. She threw the jacket down on the floor. She took off a thin, white blouse. And she noticed the tight black gloves on the wrists of her naked arms. She took the gloves off, pulling at each finger in turn. She undressed indifferently, as if she were alone in her own bedroom. Then she looked at him. She stood naked, waiting, feeling the space between them like a pressure against her stomach, knowing that it was torture for him also, and that it was as they both wanted it. Then he got up, he walked to her, and when he held her, her arms rose willingly, and she felt the shape of his body imprinted into the skin on the inside of her arm as it encircled him. His ribs, his armpit, his back, his shoulder blade under her fingers. Her mouth on his, in a surrender more violent than her struggle had been. Afterward she lay in bed by his side, under his blanket, looking at his room, and she asked, "Rourke, why were you working in that quarry?"
"You know it."
"Yes, anyone else would have taken a job in an architect's office."
"And then you'd have no desire at all to destroy me.
You understand that?"
"Yes. Keep still. It doesn't matter now."
"Do you know that the Enright House is the most beautiful building in New York?"
"I know that you know it."
"Rourke, you worked in that quarry when you had the Enright House in you and many other Enright houses, and you were drilling granite like a—"
"You're going to weaken in a moment, Dominique, and then you'll regret it tomorrow."
"Yes."
"You're very lovely, Dominique."
"Don't."
"You're lovely."
"Rourke, I'll still want to destroy you."
"Do you think I would want you if you didn't?"
"Rourke?"
"You want to hear that again? Part of it?" "I want you, Dominique. I want you. I want you."
"I—"
She stopped. The word on which she stopped almost audible in her breath. "No," he said, "not yet. You won't say that yet. Go to sleep."
"Here, with you?"
"Here, with me. I'll fix breakfast for you in the morning. Did you know that I fix my own breakfast? You like seeing that, like the work in the quarry. Then you'll go home and think about destroying me. Good night, Dominique."
Chapter 8 The blinds raised over the windows of her living room, the lights of the city rising to a black horizon halfway up the glass panes, Dominique sat at her desk, correcting the last sheets of an article, when she heard the doorbell. Guests did not disturb her without warning, and she looked up, the pencil held in mid-air, angry and curious. She heard the steps of the maid in the hall, then the maid came in, saying, "A gentleman to see you, madam." A faint hostility in her voice, explaining that the gentleman had refused to give his name. "A man with orange hair?" Dominique wanted to ask, but didn't.
The pencil jerked stiffly, and she said, "Have him come in."
Then the door opened. Against the light of the hall she saw a long neck and sloping shoulders, like the silhouette of a bottle. A rich, creamy voice said, "Good evening, Dominique." And she recognized Ellsworth Toohey, whom she had never asked to her house. She smiled. She said, "Good evening, Ellsworth. I haven't seen you for such a long time."
"You should have expected me now, don't you think so?"
He turned to the maid.
"Cointreau, please, if you have it, and I'm sure you do."
The maid glanced at Dominique, wide-eyed. Dominique nodded silently, and the maid went out, closing the door.
"Busy, of course," said Toohey, glancing at the littered desk. "Very becoming, Dominique. Gets results, too. You've been writing much better lately."
She let the pencil fall, and threw an arm over the back of her chair, half-turning to him, watching him placidly. "What do you want, Ellsworth?" He did not sit down, but stood examining the place with the unhurried curiosity of an expert.
"Not bad, Dominique. Just about as I'd expect you to have it. A little cold. You know, I wouldn't have that ice-blue chair over there, too obvious. Fits in too well. Just what people would expect in just that spot. I'd have it carrot red. An ugly, glaring, outrageous red. Like Mr. Howard Rourke's hair. That's quite en passant, merely a convenient figure of speech, nothing personal at all. Just one touch of the wrong color would make the whole room. The sort of thing that gives a place elegance. Your flower arrangements are nice. The pictures, too. Not bad."
"All right, Ellsworth, all right. What is it?"
"But don't you know that I've never been here before?" "Somehow, you've never asked me. I don't know why."
He sat down comfortably, resting an ankle on a knee, one thin leg stretched horizontally across the other, the full length of a tight gunmetal sock exposed under the trouser cuff, and a patch of skin showing above the sock, bluish-white, with a few black hairs.
"But then you've been so unsociable. The past tense, my dear, the past tense. Did you say that we haven't seen each other for a long time?" "That's true. You've been so busy. In such an unusual way. Visits, dinners, speakeasies, and giving tea parties. Haven't you?"
"I have."
"Tea parties, I thought that was tops. This is a good room for parties. Large, plenty of space to stuff people into, particularly if you're not particular whom you stuff it with, and you're not. Not now. What do you serve them? Anchovy paste and minced egg cut out like hearts?"
"Caviar and minced onion cut out like stars."
"What about the old ladies?"
"Cream cheese and chopped walnuts. In spirals."
"I'd like to have seen you taking care of things like that. It's wonderful how thoughtful you've become of old ladies, particularly the filthy rich, with sons-in-law in real estate. Though I don't think that's as bad as going to see Knock Me Flat with Commodore Higby, who has false teeth, and a nice vacant lot on the corner of Broadway and Chambers."
The maid came in with the tray. Toohey took a glass and held it delicately, inhaling, while the maid went out. "Will you tell me why the Secret Service Department, I won't ask who, and why the detailed reports on my activities?"
Dominique said indifferently. "You can ask who. Anyone and everyone. Don't you suppose people are talking about Miss Dominique Francone in the role of famous hostess, so suddenly? Miss Dominique Francone as a sort of second Kiki Holcomb, but much better, oh, much, much subtler, much abler. And then just think how much more beautiful. It's about time you made some use of that superlative appearance of yours that any woman would cut your throat for. It's still being wasted, of course, if one thinks of form in relation to its proper function, but at least some people are getting some good out of it. Your father, for instance. I'm sure he's delighted with this new life of yours. Little Dominique being friendly to people. Little Dominique who's become normal at last. He's wrong, of course, but it's nice to make him happy. A few others, too. Me, for instance. Though you'd never do anything just to make me happy. But then, you see, that's my lucky faculty, to extract joy from what was not intended for me at all, in a purely selfless way."
"You're not answering my question."
"But I am. You asked why the interest in your activities, and I answer, because they make me happy. Because, look, one could be astonished, though short-sightedly, if I were gathering information on the activities of my enemies, but not to be informed about the actions of my own side. Really, you know, you didn't think I'd be so unskilled a general. And whatever else you might think of me, you've never thought me unskilled.
Your side, Ellsworth?
Look, Dominique, that's the trouble with your written and spoken style. You use too many question marks. Bad in any case. Particularly bad when unnecessary. Let's drop the quiz technique and just talk. Since we both understand, and there aren't any questions to be asked between us. If there were, you'd have thrown me out. Instead, you gave me a very expensive liqueur. He held the rim of the glass under his nose, and inhaled with a loose kind of sensual relish, which at a dinner table would have been equivalent to a loud lip-smacking vulgar there, superlatively elegant here, over a cut crystal edge pressed to a neat little mustache.
All right, she said. Talk.
That's what I've been doing. Which is considerate of me, since you're not ready to talk. Not yet, for a while. Well, let's talk, in a purely contemplative manner, about how interesting it is to see people welcoming you into their midst so eagerly, accepting you, flocking to you. Why is it, do you suppose? They do plenty of snubbing on their own, but just let someone who snubbed them all their life suddenly break down and turn gregarious, and they all come rolling on their backs with their paws folded for you to rub their bellies. Why? There could be two explanations, I think. The nice one would be that they are generous and wish to honor you with their friendship. Only the nice explanations are never the true ones. The other one is that they know you're degrading yourself by needing them. You're coming down off a pinnacle. Every loneliness is a pinnacle, and they're delighted to drag you down through their friendship. Though, of course, none of them knows it consciously, except yourself. That's why you go through agonies doing it. And you'd never do it for a noble cause, you'd never do it except for the end you've chosen, an end viler than the means, and making the means endurable.
You know, Ellsworth, you've said a sentence there you'd never use in your column.
Did I? Undoubtedly, I can say a great many things to you that I'd never use in my column.
Which one? Every loneliness is a pinnacle.
That? Yes, quite right, I wouldn't. You're welcome to it, though it's not too good. Fairly crude. I'll give you better ones some day, if you wish. Sorry, however, that that's all you picked out of my little speech.
What did you want me to pick?
Well, my two explanations, for instance. There's an interesting question there. What is kinder, to believe the best of people and burden them with a nobility beyond their endurance, or to see them as they are and accept it because it makes them comfortable? Kindness being more important than justice, of course.
I don't give a damn, Ellsworth.
Not in a mood for abstract speculation, interested only in concrete results. All right. How many commissions have you landed for Peter Keating in the last 3 months?
She rose, walked to the tray which the maid had left, poured herself a drink, and said, 4, raising the glass to her mouth. Then she turned to look at him, standing, glass in hand, and added, And that was the famous Toohey technique. Never place your punch at the beginning of a column, nor at the end. Sneak it in where it's least expected. Fill a whole column with drivel, just to get in that one important line.
He bowed courteously. Quite. That's why I like to talk to you. It's such a waste to be subtle and vicious with people who don't even know that you're being subtle and vicious. But the drivel is never accidental, Dominique. Also, I didn't know that the technique of my column was becoming obvious. I will have to think of a new one.
Don't bother. They love it.
Of course, they'll love anything I write. So it's 4. I missed one. I counted 3.
I can't understand why you had to come here if that's all you wanted to know. You're so fond of Peter Keating, and I'm helping him along beautifully, better than you could. So if you wanted to give me a pep talk about Petey, it wasn't necessary, was it?
You're wrong there twice in one sentence, Dominique. One honest error and one lie. The honest error is the assumption that I wish to help Peter Keating,
and incidentally, I can help him much better than you can, and I have, and will. But that's long-range contemplation. The lie is that I came here to talk about Peter Keating. You knew what I came here to talk about when you saw me enter. And, oh my, you'd allow someone more obnoxious than myself to barge in on you just to talk about that subject. Though I don't know who could be more obnoxious to you than myself at the moment.
Peter Keating, she said. He made a grimace, wrinkling his nose.
Oh, no. He's not big enough for that.
But let's talk about Peter Keating. It's such a convenient coincidence that he happens to be your father's partner. You're merely working your head off to procure commissions for your father. Like a dutiful daughter, nothing more natural. You've done wonders for the firm of Francona and Keating in these last 3 months. Just by smiling at a few dowagers and wearing stunning models at some of our better gatherings. Wonder what you'd accomplish if you decided to go all the way and sell your matchless body for purposes other than aesthetic contemplation, in exchange for commissions for Peter Keating. He paused, she said nothing, and he added, "My compliments, Dominique. You've lived up to my best opinion of you, by not being shocked at this." What was that intended for, Ellsworth? Shock value or hint value?
Oh, it could have been a number of things. A preliminary feeler, for instance. But, as a matter of fact, it was nothing at all. Just a touch of vulgarity. Also the Tui technique. You know I always advise the wrong touch at the right time. I am essentially such an earnest, single-toned Puritan that I must allow myself another color occasionally to relieve the monotony.
Are you, Ellsworth? I wonder what you are, essentially. I don't know.
I dare say nobody does, he said pleasantly. Although really there's no mystery about it at all. It's very simple. All things are simple when you reduce them to fundamentals. You'd be surprised if you knew how few fundamentals there are. Only two, perhaps, to explain all of us. It's the untangling, the reducing, that's difficult. That's why people don't like to bother. I don't think they'd like the results, either.
I don't mind. I know what I am. Go ahead and say it. I'm just a bitch.
Don't fool yourself, my dear. You're much worse than a bitch. You're a saint. Which shows why saints are dangerous and undesirable.
And you?
As a matter of fact, I know exactly what I am. That alone can explain a great deal about me. I'm giving you a helpful hint, if you care to use it. You don't, of course. You might, though, in the future.
Why should I?
You need me, Dominique. You might as well understand me a little. You see, I'm not afraid of being understood. Not by you.
I need you?
Oh, come on. Show a little courage, too. She sat up and waited coldly, silently. He smiled, obviously with pleasure, making no effort to hide the pleasure. Let's see, he said, studying the ceiling with casual attention. Those commissions you got for Peter Keating. The Chryson office building was mere nuisance value. Howard Rourke never had a chance at that. The Lindsay home was better. Rourke was definitely considered. I think he would have got it but for you. The Stone Brook clubhouse also, he had a chance at that, which you ruined. He looked at her and chuckled softly. No comments on techniques and punches, Dominique? The smile was like cold grease floating over the fluid sounds of his voice. You slipped up on the Norris country house. He got that last week, you know. Well, you can't be 100% successful. After all, the Enright House is a big job. It's creating a lot of talk, and quite a few people are beginning to show interest in Mr. Howard Rourke. But you've done remarkably well. My congratulations. Now, don't you think I'm being nice to you? Every artist needs appreciation, and there's nobody to compliment you since nobody knows what you're doing, but Rourke and me, and he won't thank you. On second thought, I don't think Rourke knows what you're doing, and that spoils the fun, doesn't it? She asked,
How do you know what I'm doing?
Her voice tired. My dear, surely you haven't forgotten that it was I who gave you the idea in the first place.
Oh, yes, she said absently. Yes.
And now you know why I came here. Now you know what I meant when I spoke about my side.
Yes, she said. Of course.
This is a pact, my dear, an alliance. Allies never trust each other, but that doesn't spoil their effectiveness. Our motives might be quite opposite. In fact, they are. But it doesn't matter. The result will be the same. It is not necessary to have a noble aim in common. It is necessary only to have a common enemy. We have.
Yes.
That's why you need me. I've been helpful once.
Yes.
I can hurt your Mr. Rourke much better than any tea party you'll ever give.
What for?
Omit the what fors. I don't inquire into yours.
All right.
Then it's to be understood between us. We are allies in this. She looked at him. She slouched forward, attentive, her face empty. Then she said,
"We're allies."
Fine, my dear. Now listen. Stop mentioning him in your column every other day or so. I know you take vicious cracks at him each time, but it's too much. You're keeping his name in print, and you don't want to do that. Further, you'd better invite me to those parties of yours. There are things I can do which you can't. Another tip. Mr. Gilbert Colton, you know, the California pottery Coltons, is planning a branch factory in the East. He's thinking of a good modernist. In fact, he's thinking of Mr. Rourke. Don't let Rourke get it. It's a huge job with lots of publicity. Go and invent a new tea sandwich for Mrs. Colton. Do anything you wish. But don't let Rourke get it. She got up, dragged her feet to a table, her arms swinging loosely, and took a cigarette. She lighted it, turned to him, and said indifferently,
"You can talk very briefly and to the point, when you want to."
"When I find it necessary." She stood at the window looking out over the city. She said,
"You've never actually done anything against Rourke. I didn't know you cared quite so much."
"Oh, my dear, haven't I?"
"You've never mentioned him in print."
"That, my dear, is what I've done against Mr. Rourke. So far."
"When did you first hear of him?"
"When I saw drawings of the Heller House. You didn't think I'd miss that, did you? And you?"
"When I saw drawings of the Enright House."
"Not before."
"Not before."
She smoked in silence. Then she said, without turning to him,
"Ellsworth, if one of us tried to repeat what we said here tonight, the other would deny it, and it could never be proved. So it doesn't matter if we're sincere with each other, does it? It's quite safe. Why do you hate him?"
"I never said I hated him."
She shrugged.
"As for the rest," he added, "I think you can answer that yourself."
She nodded slowly to the bright little point of her cigarette's reflection on the glass pane. He got up, walked over to her, and stood looking at the lights of the city below them, at the angular shapes of buildings, at the dark walls made translucent by the glow of the windows, as if the walls were only a checkered veil of thin black gauze over a solid mass of radiance. And Ellsworth Toohey said softly,
"Look at it. A sublime achievement, isn't it? A heroic achievement. Think of the thousands who worked to create this, and of the millions who profit by it. And it is said that but for the spirit of a dozen men here and there down the ages, but for a dozen men, less perhaps, none of this would have been possible. And that might be true. If so, there are, again, two possible attitudes to take. We can say that these 12 were great benefactors, that we are all fed by the overflow of the magnificent wealth of their spirit, and that we are glad to accept it in gratitude and brotherhood. Or we can say that by the splendor of their achievement, which we can neither equal nor keep, these 12 have shown us what we are, that we do not want the free gifts of their grandeur, that a cave by an oozing swamp and a fire of sticks rubbed together are preferable to skyscrapers and neon lights, if the cave and the sticks are the limit of our own creative capacities. Of the two attitudes, Dominique, which would you call the truly humanitarian one? Because, you see, I'm a humanitarian." After a while, Dominique found it easier to associate with people.
She learned to accept self-torture as an endurance test, urged on by the curiosity to discover how much she could endure. She moved through formal receptions, theater parties, dinners, dances, gracious and smiling, a smile that made her face brighter and colder, like the sun on a winter day. She listened emptily to empty words, uttered as if the speaker would be insulted by any sign of enthusiastic interest from his listener, as if oily boredom were the only bond possible between people, the only preservative of their precarious dignity. She nodded to everything and accepted everything. "Yes, Mr. Holt, I think Peter Keating is the man of the century. Our century?" "No, Mr. Inskip, not Howard Rourke. You don't want Howard Rourke." "A phony? Of course he's a phony. It takes your sensitive honesty to evaluate the integrity of a man." "Nothing much." "No, Mr. Inskip, of course Howard Rourke is nothing much. It's all a matter of size and distance. And distance." "No, I don't drink very much, Mr. Inskip." "I'm glad you like my eyes. Yes, they always look like that when I'm enjoying myself. And it made me so happy to hear you say that Howard Rourke is nothing much." "You've met Mr. Rourke, Mrs. Jones? And you didn't like him?" "Oh, he's the type of man for whom one can feel no compassion." "How true. Compassion is a wonderful thing. It's what one feels when one looks at a squashed caterpillar. An elevating experience. One can let oneself go and spread. You know, like taking a girdle off. You don't have to hold your stomach, your heart, or your spirit up when you feel compassion. All you have to do is look down. It's much easier. When you look up, you get a pain in the neck. Compassion is the greatest virtue. It justifies suffering. There's got to be suffering in the world, else how would we be virtuous and feel compassion?" "Oh, it has an antithesis, but such a hard, demanding one." "Admiration, Mrs. Jones, admiration. But that takes more than a girdle." "So I say that anyone for whom we can't feel sorry is a vicious person. Like Howard Rourke." Late at night, often, she came to Rourke's room. She came unannounced, certain of finding him there, and alone. In his room there was no necessity to spare, lie, agree, and erase herself out of being. Here she was free to resist, to see her resistance welcomed by an adversary too strong to fear a contest, strong enough to need it. She found a will granting her the recognition of her own entity, untouched, and not to be touched except in clean battle, to win or to be defeated, but to be preserved in victory or defeat, not ground into the meaningless pulp of the impersonal. When they lay in bed together, it was, as it had to be, as the nature of the act demanded, an act of violence. It was surrender, made the more complete by the force of their resistance. It was an act of tension, as the great things on earth are things of tension. It was tense as electricity, the force fed on resistance, rushing through wires of metal, stretched tight. It was tense as water made into power by the restraining violence of a dam. The touch of his skin against hers was not a caress, but a wave of pain. It became pain by being wanted too much, by releasing in fulfillment all the past hours of desire and denial. It was an act of clenched teeth and hatred. It was the unendurable, the agony, an act of passion, the word born to mean suffering. It was the moment